It's Let's Talk Legal on the Talk Station, FM 107.1. And I have to say at the outset of the program, the information that we're providing here is just very, very valuable. And I want to thank our host for the program, that is Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins of Harvell and Collins. And as I begin the program, just to remind you, easy access. You can make a phone call, 252 area code 726-9050. You can visit their offices at 1107 Bridges Street in Morehead City. And I might add, you can go online at harvellandcollins.com, harvellandhollins.com. And I've got to make one other quick note on this one. Wes and Cecil, I saw that you were recently recognized by a national organization of providing professional attorney services, professional legal services. Congratulations on that. So with that as backdrop, good morning or good afternoon to you all.
Lockwood, last week, Wes and I talked about homeowners associations and the democracy that they are. We don't want to forget that there is also very akin to condominium association. There is the Planned Development Act, sometimes referred to as the PUD. Isn't that right, Wes?
Planned Community Act.
Wow.
Yeah. And it's a kind of a cousin to more of a traditional condominium association, high rise type thing. But the bottom line is that there are laws in the state of North Carolina that govern the way in which these organizations handle themselves. And so we're going to continue to talk about that today. And right out of the gate, maybe we didn't last week mention this, but what if a homeowner doesn't pay its homeowner's association fees or its assessment, maybe even it's a special assessment? I had a client in recently that told me they had to come up with $18,000 for a special assessment in their association, which was some hefty change. So what if a homeowner or a member doesn't pay these fees as they become due? We have had some cases like this in the office, and so Wes, I'll let you take it over and kind of tell us a bit about how that works. Of course, immediately it's going to work according to the way that the bylaws and the appropriate documents say that it is to work. But with that framework said, Wes, what do you have to say about that?
Probably what we can call this episode of our program is enforcement in homeowners associations, Lockwood. You know, payment of dues and assessments is certainly, you know, one of the areas of enforcement that we deal with very often at Harvell and Collins. And, you know, the way that works is basically you have your declarations or your covenants that indicates, you know, what these assessments are. There could be your annual assessments. There could be special assessments. Let's say that our roads are deteriorating and we've gotten a quote of, you know, whatever, $50,000, $100,000, and we don't have enough money in our coffers to fix our roads, and they really need to be fixed. So there could be potentially a special assessment that is imposed as long as it's allowed by the covenants, you know, $500 a lot or $1,000 a lot or $2,000 a lot or whatever it may be. And the property owners are bound by those. There's usually some limitations on how much those special assessments can be or assessments in general in the covenants. But in the event that we have a situation where someone is not paying, then the process is pretty well laid out for an association to make it easy for an association to collect on those without, you know, too much aggravation. And basically, the process would normally be, you know, send them a demand letter, you know, with regard to payment. Then you put a lien on the property. You have a notice of lien that you file. And, you know, there's some nuances and some particular language that needs to be in the document. You have to give a 15-day notice on attorney's fees. So if you have an attorney that's working for you, on it, then the attorney would know that and include that language in the letter, meaning, you know, here's what to do. You can pay this, but if you don't pay this within 15 days, then we have the right to collect attorney's fees against you as well for the process of collecting this. But mm-hmm. if you don't give the 15-day notice, you can't collect the attorney's fees. That basically gives the property owner enough time, you know, to take care of it without it becoming a bigger bill, okay? So, and once that lien is put on record, then normally there's a waiting period. Normally we give the person some time. It may be that we go through a year or two, sometimes three, of waiting for assessments to be paid. And then once they're not and they've built up a little bit to maybe, you know, a couple thousand dollars or so, then it would make financial sense at that point in time to go ahead and proceed with the foreclosure process. And again, that's very well laid out in the statutes, and it's almost always something that's referred to in the covenants as well. So we proceed forward with foreclosure on the piece of property to force the sale of the property so that the assessments, you know, can be taken care of. And honestly, we've done that probably, I don't know, dozens of times over the years, if not more. I can't remember one of those situations that have gone all the way to foreclosure and the property has had to be sold. Because normally when you get that serious with it to the point where the person's property is going to be foreclosed upon and essentially sold on the courthouse steps to pay these back dues and assessments and interest and attorney's fees, then they come up with the money, or they come up with the money, you know, pretty early on before we ever get to that process. So the process is there. Associations obviously don't like to do that. They don't like to have to go through that process. The statute protects associations and boards for associations to allow them to go through that process because, you know, if you buy into the association, buy into a subdivision that has covenants, then you're going to be bound by the language of the covenants, and covenants will always have language in them, almost in every situation I've ever seen, where, you know, you've got to contribute to the financial well-being of the subdivision as a whole. So that's that process. Now, let me kind of switch gears to another element with regard to enforcement. So as I've just gone through, the collection of assessments is not, you know, it's not overly complicated. It is very well laid out now and leads to a foreclosure. But what if we have a situation where we have someone who has just violated the covenants?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's say they've gone and built something on their property without approval or without approval of the Architectural Control Committee if that's in violation of the covenants. Or let's say that we have a situation where you know, someone has you know, just continues to you know, park a RV, mm-hmm. you know, and when it's not allowed, you know, any of these type things. But normally these situations kind of deal more with folks doing some type of construction that's not allowed. Okay, and before I go down that path, let me make sure I distinguish something. We need to understand that, you know, just because you have a building permit, okay, and just because the building
right.
planning and inspections has looked at your plans and approved your plans, that doesn't mean that they're approved by the covenants and by the association, because there may be higher level of scrutiny with regard to, and a higher level of restriction in the covenants as opposed to what the building code would require, or the planning inspections department would require. So be sure that if you're in a subdivision and you're subject to these covenants declarations, that you make sure that you get, you know, formal approval of what you're doing before you go build.
Right.
Okay. So, but if we end up in that, I mean, we've had a case recently that was, you know, someone decided that this was a place down east that they decided that, well, I own two lots and own this one where I'm building my house and I have my house on this neighboring lot. I'm going to put up a garage for my boat. So what, or workshop garage. So what do I, you know, so I'll just go ahead and just do what I want to do and mm-hmm. build that out there. Well, the covenants expressly stated that all lots are for residential purposes only and uh-huh. have some specific language yeah. in them with regard to what could be built. And the construction had to have a single family, had to be a single family residence. It's right. not that you can't have a garage, it just need to be associated, you know, with the particular single family residence, not, you know, just a garage in the middle of a lot. So another case, an individual got basically sought approval for some land altering work on his lot and got approval from the Architectural Control Committee, but then went and did something completely different than what mm-hmm. his plans showed. And really created some problems with regard to access to a common area and a lot of other things. So basically the process there, when you have a breach of covenants, is, you know, you first of all, the board, or if you have what's called an adjudicatory panel, that's like a panel that's that is put in place by the board that considers these type of things. Normally, in Carter County, Eastern North Carolina, we don't have an adjudicatory panel with associations. The board does all of this, mm-hmm. and that's fine. That's not a problem. So basically, they consider what the problem is and make a determination initially as to whether they believe that there's a breach of the covenants. And that's really important. If a board, you know, looks at what someone's built on their property and they decide, well, I don't like it, so we're going to make them not do it.
Right.
Well, that's not the standard. The standard is whether it's in breach of the covenants. So not, it doesn't matter if some people on the board don't like it. If it's in compliance with the covenants, then too bad.
Mm-hmm.
So because we all have to live with the language in the covenants. So be it as it may, so if you have a board that's made that determination, then they put it in writing, this is the problem, this is the part of the covenants that you're in violation of. Please correct this issue. And if they don't do that, then that oftentimes then leads to this process under the Planned Community Act that I was referring to a moment ago, where the association can fine people. It's not assessments, it's a fine.
Okay.
Okay. And so a hearing is established. When we represent associations, those hearings are normally and often held at our office, just at the conference room table. And in that notice for the hearing, we give notice to the supposed violator of the covenants, and that's their opportunity to come forward and to say what they want to say, to put on evidence as to why they think they're not in violation. Okay, and the board just listens to that. They're basically just taking in information at that meeting. And then once that process is concluded, then the board normally then discusses the information and makes a determination as to whether it is in fact a violation. And they have the right to then fine the individuals up to, but not more than, $100 per day in order to, as a actual, obviously an incentive, for the people to correct the problem, $100 per day. And that $100 per day starts 5 days after the notice is given. You then send a notice to the property owner and say, hey, this garage is not in violation, or not in, is not consistent with our covenants. It needs to be taken down. $100 per day will start now. And, you know, it's then up to the property owner as to whether they want to comply or not. And if they don't, then the $100 a day will accrue, and that obviously about $3,000 a month and
right.
$36,000 a year.
And yeah.
It kind of adds up, plus interest, plus attorney's fees. So it can get expensive. So it's important for associations to know that the Planned Community Act affords them that process I just went through. If you have someone in violation of the covenants, you don't, and you feel like it, as the association, it needs to be addressed. You don't have to run off to court, you know, to file a lawsuit, to get an injunction, to get them to remove it and do all that kind of stuff. You can do it through this deterrent action through the Planned Community Act.
You know, this leads to a bunch of questions. We're talking, that was Wes Collins of Harvell and Collins here on Let's Talk Legal. And I want to remind you very quickly that you can reach out to Wes or Cecil. Cecil's listening in. He started the initiation initiated this conversation. Reach out to them at 252 area code 726-9050, 726-9050, or go online at harvellandcollins.com. Back to you, Wes, on this topic of the issue of fines and also the liens, things of this nature. It strikes me, and Cecil, you alluded to this earlier, it's a quasi-democracy that we're dealing with here. My question is, can any of this end up in a court of law where a jury might, in a jury trial, could any of this, or is it, as you said a few moments ago, Cecil, it's almost like it's a totally... bubble. It's a total bubble. It's a total inclusive democracy, a government, form of government. Can it, I'll use that word, pierce that bubble and go into the public?
Absolutely.
Well, Lockwood, one of the things that could happen is that no matter how diligent we write as legislators, lawyers, there can be ambiguity, there can be confusion about terminology, and so sometimes these documents are subject to interpretation,
right.
And as such, there might be a lawsuit where there might be a declaratory judgment on a particular paragraph or phrase, something of that nature. But by and large, and Wes, you tell me your experience with this, but by and large, it is somewhat black and white, Lockwood. That's your point. I mean, wow. you either pay up or you have this penalty, interest, et cetera, and eventually there's a lien against your property.
Wow.
That's a fairly black and white case file, but there certainly are times that there are interpretations.
Okay.
Don't you agree, Wes?
Yeah, I mean, there could be problems with the covenants. I mean, we're trying to enforce a provision that may be ambiguous, and a party could say, well, look, I don't think that you guys can fine me because I don't think I'm in violation because I don't interpret it the way that you do. So I'm going to file a lawsuit to set aside this fine and to ask the court to enter a declaration as to what is actually meant by this language. So you could end up in that situation.
Okay.
You could also end up in a situation where if the association, through this fining procedure, does not strictly follow all of the requirements of the Planned Community Act under the particular statute, which is 47F-3-107.1, that's just the fining statute, then there is going to be no fine that will be upheld by a court. So you have to follow the procedure specifically.
Mm-hmm.
You can't be, there's not really substantial compliance here. It's not really like, okay, well, we didn't do it just right, but it was close.
Right.
No, you have to do it perfectly. So I guess the answer with regard to that and the advice is that let's not go through this fining procedure unless you have an attorney helping you do it,
mm-hmm.
because you don't know what's going to happen in the future. It could be that you have a property owner who just decides, hey, I don't care what they do, I'm going to keep this thing here forever.
Right.
And it could end up being $50,000 of fines. Well, once that year and a half of fines has run up, and then that property owner files a lawsuit, and there you are as an association, and you find yourself in a lawsuit, and the best leverage you have is your $50,000 of fines, and all of a sudden we find out, well, uh-oh, we didn't follow the rules specifically. All of a sudden you lost all your leverage. So let's do everything perfectly as it relates to this, because the law is not going to support an association fining an individual for a violation when the association did not specifically follow those restrictions. That's the kind of thing that has to be strictly adhered to. Another thing I would mention briefly is that, and yes, I mean, another remedy here also would be the association could choose to file a lawsuit to seek recovery without going through the fining process. When I say recovery, I mean like an order from the court that the individual has to bring the property into compliance with the covenants, and this is what the violation is. But that is something that normally is totally and wholly unnecessary, because a lawsuit process of an association trying to require a property owner to bring the property into compliance with the covenants is just an incredibly more complicated process than simply going through the Plain Community Act fining procedure. That's the purpose of having that procedure there. That's why the General Assembly gave that to us in the Plain Community Act, which has been in place maybe 15 years, so that these homeowners association situations don't all end up spinning mm-hmm. off into court. It's a very nice tool that really acts as a deterrent for
right.
folks from violating the covenants, and allows the association to enforce these without spending a ton of money. And in many cases, they don't spend any money, because at the end of the day, the fines and the attorney's fees and the interest are paid
right.
through the process.
These planned communities, and you use the word a PUD, planned unit development,
but the Planned Community Act is where the fining procedure is.
Right. But we see these developments now, and it strikes me that it's not just a simple matter of, as we've talked about in real estate, buying a piece of property. You're buying into an association, and it brings with it certain restrictions, opportunities, of course, but also restrictions. And it strikes me that anybody who's thinking about entering into a purchase of a house or in a planned unit development or an association, or for that matter, even a condo organization,
right.
really needs to look at more than just the deed. There's a lot of, this is a little frightening, to be blunt.
Well, I'll probably sound like it's you know, frightening.
It's not a matter of, I now have my house. I can paint it any color I want. I can add to it. I can do this. I can do that. Well, if you're in a planned community, there may be some serious restrictions.
Yep.
Everything.
Well, there are in many, many mm-hmm. respects. You know, you just can't go do whatever you want to do.
Right.
And that's because that's what you bought into.
I mean,
there's uniformity in neighborhoods
right.
that are controlled by covenants. And that uniformity is decided basically by the developer when they develop the property and mm-hmm. make a determination as to what type of subdivision they want this to be. You know, let's say a developer goes out and buys a tract of land and spends all the money that's necessary to put in the roads, put in the subdivision plat,
mm-hmm.
put in the infrastructure, get all the zoning done. I mean, that's a lot of money,
right?
You know, to set that up, and you know, you're doing that for purposes of doing what? Well, selling off lots and making a profit. Well, let's say that a developer does that and doesn't put any restrictions on the property at all. Well, if there's, when I say restrictions, no covenants.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you do that, you're selling a subdivision that could have a 4,000 square foot house next to a single wide.
Right.
Next to a parking garage.
Yes.
Next to a, you know, whatever the only restriction there would be zoning. And so, you know, you kind of shoot yourself in the foot if you do that, because as a developer, you know, you're going to be able to get the highest and best price and use out of these lots by creating a nice uniform development, so that everyone can kind of trust what's going to go on in this particular subdivision.
You know, it makes sense. It's just that
Lockwood is touching and concerning going up the ladder to kind of the global picture. It doesn't it all begin with just zoning?
Mm-hmm. Right.
I mean, when we buy our property, we are buying into usually an area that has, you know, public zoning.
Right.
And if it is zoned residential, then we're going to be honor bound by that.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to be required to use the property only as residential. We're not going to be able to build, you know, an office building or some other kind of commercial establishment. And so it is akin to that. And then kind of a subcategory under the zoning that should be checked carefully when one is buying property are then, yes, absolutely, these restrictions, these covenants, these limitations on one's ownership. And sometimes there are just the restrictions. On a positive note, and I think Wes was alluding to that, there are just the restrictions.
Right.
That's a little bit different than in an association where there are monthly or quarterly fees,
mm-hmm.
the ability for the association to assess the unit owner or the homeowner, to make special assessments, things of that nature. So there are degrees of these kinds of restrictions. Sometimes it's just simply, you know, zoning, residential, and then that every home within that particular subdivision is going to be, you know, a stick-built home,
mm-hmm.
Traditional construction, and not to exceed or not to be under a certain square footage.
Right. Yeah.
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 So there are degrees of the way in which we are limited in our use of our property. And I could just go on and on about this, but I know our time is gone or is leaving. But one more thing, Lockwood, just real quickly, is how about nuisances?
Mm-hmm.
You know, barking dogs, fires out in the yard, mm-hmm. developing lots of smoke and being a hazard to others. You know, pools and pits and all of these kinds of things, livestock, lots and lots of things on property can be, even though there are no restrictive covenants, there can be, they can be deemed to be a nuisance. And so that just, home ownership is not as simple as sometimes we want to think it is.
It is not. I know that the assumption is that we're buying a home. Well, we're buying a lot more than a home. And I think that's the important part of this conversation today with Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins of Harvell and Collins. And by the way, I want to remind you, you can reach out to them by phone, 252 area code 726-9050, or go online to harvellandcollins.com. Spell out the word and, Harvell and Collins. I think that this is an important topic for many of us here, particularly in coastal North Carolina, where we're seeing the development of, the development of more planned unit developments, association organizations, and, of course, condominiums. So I think this is an important topic. I want to thank you, Cecil and Wes. This has been a very important conversation. and I look forward to further conversations in the weeks ahead.
Okay, thank you, Lockwood.